Welcome to the 25th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. Recently, we traveled to Washington, D.C. for a State of the Science Summit on non-small cell lung cancer. At the meeting, topics ranged from determining optimal strategies for molecular interrogation and non-small cell lung cancer to the emergence of rare, targetable biomarkers such as MET, RET, and NTRK. Presentations are focused on additional recent advances in the NSC, LC, and small cell lung cancer paradigms, touching on TKIs, immunotherapy, and other investigational agents. During our time in D.C., we had the opportunity to speak with Benjamin P. Levy, MD, co-chair of the meeting, and an assistant professor of oncology. Dr. Levy also serves as the clinical director of medical oncology at Johns Hopkins Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center of Johns Hopkins Medicine. Levy kicked off the night by highlighting the many benefits of attending State of the Science meetings with special insight on what makes these events so unique.
It's first an honor to be a chair of the State of Science meeting here in Washington, D.C. These meetings are a little different. They're a little more intimate. There is a little closer environment. And the purpose is really to review all the relevant data. Keep in mind, the data is rapidly evolving. So when you have a meeting like this and be able to bring in world-class experts to deliver the information, distill the complexity, and really make it palatable to the audience, it's a meaningful venue for this. So, we have a host of great speakers who are talking about different topics within lung cancer, everything from targeted therapies to immunotherapies to the role of neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapies. And it's really emblematic of the complexity of this tumor. And it's always great to get people who come through the door and not only attend but ask questions. That type of close-knit environment does provide that. And it's interesting, I think the people from the community that come to these learn a lot, but I also learn a lot from them. Their questions, what's on their mind, it really helps me understand what they're having challenges with, and often sometimes I learn a new practice pattern that may be out there that I wasn't aware of in my silo of academic medicine.
Although the story of molecular profiling began with EGFR and ALK, other actionable mutations such as ROS1 and BRAF, as well as other rare mutations like MET, RET, and NTRK, are showing significant responses to investigational targeted therapies, some of which have already received FDA approval, and others that are on track to receive it. We sat down with Alexander E. Drillin, MD, a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, who further discussed the breakthrough therapy designations granted by the FDA, such as crizotinib in the MET space and LUXO-292, which is targeted against RET fusions. You can hear Drillin further highlight emerging biomarkers in NSCLC and these therapeutic agents that have been developed to target them.
Beyond EGFR, ALK, and ROS1, there are several other biomarkers that are paired to match targeted therapies. The first group are the MET exon 14 alterations, and these are found in about 4% of non-small cell lung cancers. Interestingly, a frequency that's very similar to ALK in some series. These are mutations that result in activation of the MET pathway, and fortunately, they're amenable to targeted therapy with MET inhibitors. And there are a bunch of MET inhibitors that were in development when we were able to detect these exon 14 alterations in clinical samples, and so trials evolve very rapidly. Now we have data on crizotinib, capmatinib, and tepotinib. These three drugs are either selective vis-a-vis capmatinib or tepotinib, or crizotinib, which is a multi-kinase inhibitor. And across the board, the response rates are in the order of about 30%. So not quite what we're used to seeing for EGFR, ALK, ROS, or BRAF with combination therapy. However, there was a recent report of capmatinib in TKI-naive patients having a response rate that exceeded 70%. We're not quite sure how durable those responses are, but it's something to look forward to because it is an unmet need. Suffice to say that I think that the MET space is moving forward very quickly, and crizotinib at least has breakthrough designation by the FDA, and we hope at some point to see some type of approval for this genomic subset.
Turning to newly available treatment options for patients with EGFR-positive NSCLC was Chul Kim, MD, MPH, an attending physician at MedStar Health, and an assistant professor of medicine at Georgetown University. He provided considerations for thoracic oncologists to help them distinguish among TKIs available in the frontline setting. When we sat down with Kim, he discussed the addition of osimertinib and dacomitinib to the treatment armamentarium and provided further insight on the clinical trials that led to their approvals.
There have been a great deal of advances in the field of EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer, and this year we have two additional EGFR TKIs that are approved for the first-line treatment of non-small cell lung cancer with the EGFR mutations. Those are osimertinib, which is third-generation EGFR TKI, and dacomitinib, a second-generation EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor. Osimertinib was approved based on the results from the FLORA trial that compared osimertinib to first-generation EGFR TKI, gefitinib or erlotinib, and the trial showed that a superior median progression-free survival with osimertinib and over gefitinib or erlotinib. And what was also remarkable was that the patients who had CNS disease at baseline also benefited, as well as those who didn't have a CNS metastasis. That suggests that the efficacy of osimertinib for the CNS disease. Dacomitinib, which is approved based on the results from the ARCHER 1050 trial, in the trial, dacomitinib was compared with gefitinib. And actually, this is the first trial that showed overall survival benefit when trials compared to EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And so this was another big development in the field. Now we have five different EGFR tyrosine kinases for the first-line treatment. One issue is that, one practical question is that, you know, how to select first-line treatment. If you compare median PFS from different trials, certainly osimertinib provides the best PFS. Although caution needs to be exercised when you make cross-trial comparisons. And also, osimertinib is associated with a more favorable side effect profile compared to second-generation EGFR TKIs, less grade 3 or 4 rash or diarrhea, and then not many patients require dose reduction compared to afatinib or dacomitinib. One unanswered question, which requires more research, in my opinion, is that whether there is any subset of patients who may benefit from sequential approach. For example, if you start with the dacomitinib, which will give you about 15 months median PFS, followed by osimertinib. In the second line setting, osimertinib can provide, can yield about 10 months PFS benefit. If you combine those two numbers, it's 25 months, which is certainly better than 19 months with the first generation, first line osimertinib. However, one caveat is that we do not have a validated way of predicting who will develop T790M. So that is a major issue. So going forward, more research needs to be done to understand if there's any subset of patients who may benefit from sequential approach versus first line osimertinib.
At the conference, Stephen V. Liu, MD, gave a thorough presentation on the evolving treatment paradigm for patients with ALK-positive NSCLC. The first-line space, for example, continues to rapidly evolve. Although alectinib has become the current standard of care for the majority of this patient population, positive data with frontline brigatinib has the potential to shake up the landscape once more. In our interview, Liu, who serves as an associate professor of medicine at MedStar Georgetown University Medical Center, highlights how ALK-positive NSCLC treatment has evolved over the last few years.
So if we think of our frontline treatment for ALK-positive cancer, it really almost is an embarrassment of riches, and it's evolved a lot in a pretty short period of time. If we go back to Profile 1014, we saw that crizotinib was superior to chemotherapy, but now after 4+ years of follow-up, we can see that those patients have a significant improvement in survival if they receive the right treatment. But what's most interesting is that patients who start with crizotinib instead of chemotherapy, but then continue with ALK-targeted therapy afterwards, had the best possible outcome, which really suggests targeted therapy is your best first treatment, but also your best subsequent treatment. And for most patients, we'll want to remain on targeted therapy for as long as we can. The first-line space has gone on to evolve. We saw ceritinib in the ASCENT-4 study superior to chemotherapy, but really the biggest change was with the ALEX trial, when alectinib was compared to crizotinib head-to-head, chemotherapy no longer really being an appropriate standard of care. So alectinib was far superior, and we saw an updated ASCO 2018 with a median progression-free survival of almost 3 years compared to 11 months with crizotinib, a hazard ratio of less than 0.5, and really cementing its place as the preferred first-line option. A couple weeks ago at ESMO 2018, we saw the Alessia trial, which was an Asian study, but the same design of alectinib versus crizotinib using the standard 600 milligram dose. And we saw that, again, far superior. And the investigator initiated progression-free survival comparing alectinib to crizotinib, a hazard ratio of 0.22, which is a ridiculous hazard ratio, but clearly cementing it as our preferred first-line option. Alectinib, just an excellent, well-tolerated, highly effective drug.
We also sat down with Deepa S. Subramanian, MBBS, MSc, who is the director of the Multidisciplinary Thoracic Oncology Clinic and the director of the Brain Tumor Center at MedStar Health. Although crizotinib is the only FDA approved thus far for patients with ROS1 positive NSCLC, other agents are being explored in clinical trials. Although the needle has not moved forward too much in BRAF positive NSCLC, the combination of dabrafenib and trametinib holds promise. Listen here to hear Dr. Subramanian shed light on the complex and evolving paradigm of both ROS1 and BRAF-driven NSCLC.
Well, for ROS1-directed cancers, the only approved therapy at this point really is crizotinib. However, we have a lot of exciting new drugs that are in development. There are three that are notable. Those are entrectinib, as well as lorlatinib, and repotrectinib. Entrectinib has already completed its ROS1 basket trial. It does appear that the response rate as well as the median duration of response and progression-free survival are all superior to crizotinib when you compare the numbers. And it is likely that this drug will be approved for treatment-naive patients with ROS1-positive cancer. However, this drug is not particularly effective in patients who have already received prior crizotinib. So I think it's for these patients that we're going to be starting to see the benefit of drugs, the newer drugs, such as lorlatinib and repotrectinib. And we're still waiting for the final data from the repotrectinib trial, which is still ongoing. As for a BRAF-targeted therapy, there's not a lot of activity in that field, but thankfully we do have one very viable combination in dabrafenib plus trametinib, which has a 64% objective response rate in this population. There are not a lot of other combinations in these patients, so at this point, once we've exhausted this combination, we'll probably have to move on to treating these patients as though they did not have a driver mutation.
Turning to the use of immunotherapy in NSCLC was Patrick M. Ford, MBBCH, an assistant professor of oncology at Johns Hopkins Medicine. The PD-L1 inhibitor, durvalumab, showed a median PFS by blinded independent central review of 17.2 months compared with 5.6 months with placebo in those with stage 3 unresectable NSCLC who had stable disease following chemo radiotherapy. The clinical benefit of immunotherapy has also been observed in patients with resectable disease. Neoadjuvant nivolumab demonstrated a pathologic complete response of 45% in patients whose tumors were completely resected in surgery. When we sat down with Ford, he reflected on the progress made in this space and highlighted key clinical trials in early stage disease.
Kind of moving on a little bit in the spectrum of lung cancer, for stage 3 lung cancer patients where the tumors are not amenable to surgery. We got data at the World Lung Cancer Conference in September showing that durvalumab, another of the anti-PD-L1 antibodies, given after definitive chemoradiation, so where patients get 6 weeks of chemoradiation. If durvalumab is given for a year after that, it prolongs both time to tumor progression, but also, most importantly, it prolongs overall survival for those patients and is generally well tolerated. So it's become a definite new standard of care for those patients.
We also sat down with Julie R. Bramer, MD, an associate professor of oncology and co-director of the Upper Aerodigestive Department at the Bloomberg Institute of Cancer Immunotherapy at Johns Hopkins Medicine. She discussed updates on the use of immunotherapy in patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. Specifically, she highlighted promising data from three pivotal trials, KEYNOTE-024, KEYNOTE-189, and KEYNOTE-407, all of which cemented pembrolizumab's role in the metastatic setting for patients with squamous and non-squamous histologies.
The majority of patients are now being offered immunotherapy based on several studies. One of the KEYNOTE studies, which compared pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy in patients with high PD-L1 tumor proportion score, has shown a significant improvement in survival. So that's one option for that group of patients with high PD-L1 that do not have EGFR or ALK abnormality. Also looking at combining it with chemotherapy. Now that's the standard of care for the rest of the patients, as well as those patients with high PD-L1. That's an additional option based on the KEYNOTE studies comparing chemotherapy versus chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab. And there were two separate studies, one looking at non-squamous cell histology, looking at pemetrexed and carboplatin. Another KEYNOTE trial looked at nab-paclitaxel plus platinum plus pembrolizumab or paclitaxel plus carboplatinum plus or minus pembrolizumab. And both of those trials did show an advantage of giving chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab.
Lastly, Christine Lee Han, MD, PhD, discussed the new standard of care for the frontline treatment of patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer, atezolizumab and chemotherapy, based on results from the Phase 3 IMpower133 trial, which demonstrated an improvement in survival with the addition of the PD-L1 inhibitor to standard carboplatin and etoposide compared with chemotherapy alone. In our interview, Han, an associate professor of oncology at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, explained how recent data have shifted a mostly stagnant small cell lung cancer landscape.
There's been a renewed interest in studying small cell lung cancer as part of the Recalcitrant Tumor Act. And as a consequence, there's been increased NCI funding trying to study this cancer. I think this has emerged in parallel with increasing technology, which allows us on smaller and smaller samples to really look at genomic, epigenetic, and proteomic profiles of small cell lung cancer. So I would say in the last 5 years, there's been increasing information on proteins that are aberrantly expressed in small cell lung cancer that may be targets. Those include PARP, PARP as a target, as well as really trying to refine specific molecular subsets of small cell lung cancer. I think it's going to take a long time to really tease through some of these details. And small cell lung cancer is one of the cancers that has the highest tumor mutation burden. So there might be a greater role for combined targeted therapy as opposed to cancers that are driven by a single oncogenic mutation. So for small cell lung cancer, there have been very few studies looking at limited stage small cell lung cancer. While there's curative potential with chemotherapy and radiation, still the vast majority of patients recur locally and distantly, and there are very few studies looking at this. So there are immune checkpoint inhibitor studies currently underway, and I think that will help us understand better how immunotherapy can be used in the earlier stage setting, especially with the exciting news of durvalumab in stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer. There's a lot of hope that immunotherapy may play a role in patients with small cell lung cancer who have received radiation. And then I think that there is, now that immunotherapy is moving into the first line setting for patients with extensive stage small cell, there may be downstream impact on what patients can receive in the second and third line setting, whether that's combined immunotherapy, immunotherapy combined with targeted agents, or simply targeted therapies.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 25th episode of OncLive on Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science Summits. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you want to hear more about the treatment landscape of gastrointestinal malignancies, consider registering for the February 7th State of the Science Summit in Houston, Texas. We will also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on February 21st in Washington, D.C., also on gastrointestinal malignancies. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at @OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.